I'm Afshin Ratansi and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. It's been just over a month since Israel failed to prevent massive Palestinian resistance retaliation for decades of slaughter in Gaza. The response from Tel Aviv is thousands of children killed by a NATO nation-backed multi-billion dollar military-industrial complex. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned the world not to treat the atrocities of October the 7th as if they happened in a vacuum. And no historian has done more to explain the context of mass murder in Palestine than Professor Ilan Pape, director of the European Center for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter and author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine. He's in Haifa, partitioned from Palestine by the UN in 1947. Professor Pape, thank you so much for coming on again on Going Underground. Last time you were on for a book that probably educated so many of those demonstrating in those NATO nations against what's happening in the Middle East right now. I've got to really begin by asking you why the lack of compassion across Israel for Gaza. I know a lot of the images are censored in NATO nations, presumably in Israel as well, but why the lack of seeming compassion for what the rest of the world is seeing Israel's troops do to Gaza?
Thank you for having me once again on your program. I think that there's nothing new in the way and the lack of compassion, as you say. I mean, I've been experiencing it long before the 7th of October. If I try to speak with Israelis just on the human side of the catastrophe of 1948, I failed to see any compassion. I remember the attack on Gaza in 2014, with then quite a high number of children killed, and I couldn't extract any compassionate reaction from most of the Israeli Jews I knew, and definitely there was no compassion conveyed through the main media or through the discourse of the politician. Why is it happening? I think this has a lot to do with the nature of Zionism as a settler colonial movement. I mean, you have to go to the origins, and like many other settler colonial movements, like the ones that established the United States and Australia, for instance, in order to get rid of the native indigenous population, you had to dehumanize them first and foremost. And there's nothing new in the way Israelis perceive most of the Palestinians, even the young ones, as potential enemies, as an existential danger. They are not getting to that conclusion by themselves. It is the outcome of a very deep indoctrination, educational system. And it is sustained by the media. I mean, you just have to hear Benjamin Netanyahu's language when he talks about the Palestinians. People think that this is a new language because of what happens on the 7th of October, but this is because people have very short memory. He spoke the same way throughout his career as a prime minister, and you probably remember yourself, Prime Minister Begin, and the way he talked about Arafat in 1982 during the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, when he compared Arafat to Hitler in the bunker. So I'm afraid that this is not unique to the particular catastrophe that we are witnessing today. It's a more structural Israeli-Jewish perception, I would say racist perception, of the Palestinians as subhumans or infrahuman, as some of our good friends like Zizek likes to refer to, or Agamben as well.
And some might say that that lack of compassion is reflected, of course, in London, Berlin, and notably Washington, not wanting a ceasefire. Do you think that many Jews in what was Palestine understand that the biblical prophecy adhered to by the American Christian right, from which American politicians get their voters from, they end up believing in Judeocide on the Day of Judgment? Do you think they understand that?
That's a very good point. I remember the early honeymoon between Benjamin Netanyahu when he was still the Israeli ambassador to the United Nations. He started in 1992 as this serious connection with the Christian Zionists. And he was asked about these, the fine letters in the contract, namely that Jews would be either barbecued in hell all converted to Christianity in this divine scenario of the end of time. And he said that doesn't matter now. What matters is that now we have genuine allies. And I think that's how the Israelis treat it. But most Israelis, I would say, are unaware, of course, of this. And they just are very ignorant. They don't know very much. And their media feeds them that kind of narrative and historical knowledge which fits the ideology and the propaganda rather than allows them to be critical thinkers and take a more independent position towards the reality.
So, given what we've been seeing in recent weeks, are we seeing the beginning of the end, or could we be seeing the end of the Israel project?
It's a very good question. I think that the internal Israeli war that kind of raged before the 7th of October between what I called the state of Judea, namely the state of the settlers, messianic, theocratic, fundamentalist, and the state of Israel, the more secular kind of multicultural version of Israeli apartheid, were fighting each other for the future. I think this, despite the fact that it has stopped, of course, because of the war, will be resumed very soon. I already can see the indication for it erupting again. This implosion from within, I think, indicates or is a precursor for the beginning of the end, or the end of the beginning, if you want. But I do warn you and the viewer as an historian, these processes, which we term as beginning of an end, can be quite long in our lifetime. And more important, they are quite vicious and fierce. We remember the last days of apartheid South Africa and some other regimes like that. And therefore, yes, I do think that the whole validity of this project is not holding water. And as Gideon Levy, the brave Israeli journalist, said in Haaretz, it seems that we are going towards only two options, and I agree with him. Either a new Nakba, and this is unfolding in front of our eyes as we speak, or a one democratic state for all. I still hope, and I have to be, I'm an activist as well as an historian, I have to be optimist, that despite the unfolding of the first option, maybe with international and regional intervention, we might build the basis for the second option. There's no third option. The present reality will not stay forever. So it's either a total catastrophe or hopefully building a very different future for both Palestinians and Jews in the historical land of Palestine.
But of course, accompanying all of this are these warships and perhaps one of the largest NATO nation armadas in history in the Eastern Mediterranean. The former Secretary General of the Arab League, Amr Moussa, on Saturday's show smiled when I asked, why is it everyone keeps invoking Iran when it comes to Hamas, a Sunni organization that supported, at some guises, the US policy in Syria, trying to overthrow President Assad? How successful is the media and Netanyahu and Joe Biden and European leaders in trying to make out that this is somehow to do with Iran, the October 7th attack?
Yes, I think we have here a battle of narratives, and we have something that I call the battle of the pretext with the context. And namely, people use the 7th of October as a pretext to implement policies that they were unable to implement in full before. Let's take the Americans. The Americans used the events of the 7th of October as a pretext to resend or reassert military presence in the area and to try and win back some of the hegemony they have lost due to their failed policies after 2001. Israeli leaders use the events as a pretext to implement massive ethnic cleansing, which they could not implement during a time of no war. I don't call it time of peace because there was no peace, but at least in time of no war, Israel is fully aware that during a war you can do much more in terms of mass expulsions than you can do during the time of no war. So yes, I do think that this is one battle of narrative. The other one is, of course, to build this story that Iran is behind everything, like an octopus that sends all its whatever you call them, hands into various areas, instead of listening to the Secretary General of the United Nations, who would say, Hamas doesn't need Iran, Palestinians don't need Iran to resist throughout the years of occupation, colonization, and oppression against the Israelis. There's no need for any power from the outside, whether regional or international, to tell a colonized people who are exposed to ethnic cleansing and now genocidal policies. They don't need someone from the outside to tell them to try and resist and to cry to the world, stop this colonization and oppression. It's quite incredible how some intelligent people in the West are repeating this narrative, which comes out of Hollywood, but has nothing to do with the reality on the ground. Anyone who knows the Palestinian struggle from the very beginning knows that Christians and Muslims are involved in it, that it has a very strong left side to it as well, that it relies on Russia, China, and Iran, and Brazil, and other countries who are willing to challenge American hegemony. I mean, this is a typical third world anti-colonialist struggle that just, in terms of periodization, is outside the conventional framework of most of the anti-colonial and successful struggles that happened probably between the 1970s until the end of the last century. But this is an ongoing struggle that belongs to that period. It just didn't materialize yet.
I know there's a picture on social media of Che Guevara in Gaza doing the rounds. And of course, Luis Arce, who we interviewed on this show, the president of Bolivia, has severed diplomatic relations with Israel. We saw Colombia acting, and as you say, Brazil, China, Russia, all these different voices, quietly confident that the Arab world doesn't really matter when it comes to what's happening in Gaza, regardless of apparently a summit in Saudi Arabia on Saturday. They don't really have any impact into what happens to Palestinians and all the thousands of children being killed.
Yes, but it's a very risky position by the Arab regimes, because unlike the regimes themselves, the societies are very pro-Palestinians, still regard Palestine as a symbol for the struggle of the Arab world altogether to be liberated, to thrive, and to progress. Going in such a clear way against the wishes of most of the people who live in the in these Arab countries can be very dangerous in the future. I think it's not a coincidence that during the so-called Arab Spring, so many of the demonstrators donned themselves with the Palestinian flag. I think there is a kind of an understanding that there is a very complex reality here. You have some regimes that are far more committed to the struggle on the side of the Palestinians, like the Syrian one. And at the same time, they also have their own issues of human rights and civil rights that the Arab world wants to solve, which gives you a very clear indication that without a just solution for the Palestine question, the Arab world will not be able to deal with issues of human rights and civil rights, release itself from the grip of American imperialism, and build itself as an independent and important actor in international relations.
Professor Ilan Pappa, I'll stop you there. More from the director of the European Centre for Palestinian Studies at the University of Exeter after this break.
There's no end in sight over how you're going to continue to destroy the Earth.
It's the case of the madness of the people.
I tried to go to the gym, but I'm certainly not ready to fight Russia.
This is all so absurd.
This is third world lunacy. Brainwashing.
As Ursula von der Leyen likes to say, we have the tools.
Why don't we just start with stability and business deals?
What planet are we living on now?
We have very good propaganda in our press here in Europe.
I think we don't know the aftermath.
Anytime that you're not allowed to ask questions, you should ask all of the questions.
The more questions asked, the better the answers will be.
Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the renowned historian and author of The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine, Professor Ilan Pape. Well, we were talking about instability in this region, but of course, it becomes increasingly clear that in the same NATO countries arming the alleged genocide in Gaza, there seems to be a degree of instability given that British politicians are considering banning the Palestinian flag in Britain. Shockingly, obviously, the United States wouldn't do that. They have a First Amendment. What makes this conflict and as I say, alleged genocide occurring now so different in terms of blowback when it comes to civic society in the United States and Western Europe?
I think that it is important to state from the very beginning that as horrific as this event is, it's not a game changer. However, the events in Gaza will unfold, Israel would still be an apartheid state, Zionism would still be a settler colonial state, and the Palestinians would still be a colonized people struggling with very little regional and international help to try and win their liberation, independence, and freedom. So I think that when you view it from that perspective, you can see that there may be a change in the level of support of the civil society. Maybe it's even more, maybe it's higher than it was. And there, and exactly the mirror image of it, there is even less tolerant by the governments in the West to allow freedom of speech on Palestine. I think all this would, fortunately or unfortunately, depends how you look at it, go back to its previous levels, namely, I'm afraid that the levels of solidarity and support for the Palestinians would not be the same after the events in Gaza again, however they would end. But on the other hand, I'm quite sure that the draconian measures that the British government, for example, is taking may not really stay in place. So that it really shows us that as activists, especially in the solidarity movement, we should think about this as a chapter. And not as an event out of context, and everything we faced as challenges, and the biggest challenge we have, at least in the global north and in the west, is a civil society that is very pro-Palestinian, and yet unable until today to have any significant influence on the policies of the governments towards Palestine. This is for me the main issue. I'm less disturbed, although I'm outraged, of course, when President Biden tries to explain why he does not support the Chinese and Russian call for a ceasefire, which is the most normal and right thing to do. I don't think how they can sleep at night knowing what it means not to call for a ceasefire. But all in all, I don't think that this is that different from their policies in the future, in the past. And I'm afraid this will be also their policies in the future. My only hope is that somehow the civil societies, the solidarity movement, maybe the Muslim world, maybe the Arab world, would step, upgrade, call it what you want, the solidarity with the Palestinians and make it a much more effective factor in changing the reality on the ground, not just in order to stop the genocide in Gaza, but also to change the reality. Because as you probably know, more than 100 Palestinians were killed since the beginning of the 7th of October in the West Bank. Thousands have been arrested without a trial. And the Palestinian citizens in Israel are being harassed daily by the police and Jewish citizens. So we have here a situation where all the Palestinians, all of historical Palestine, need urgently the international community and the region to intervene, because the imbalance of power at this moment in history is against them.
Or is there a change? Because as per events at the UN Security Council after the UAE-backed resolution, it is now OK, according to London, Berlin, Washington, that killing children in vast numbers on the basis of their ethnicity is OK now, as per self-defense. That's now been established.
Yeah. I'm even willing to give them some sort of margin of doubt that they do not fully understand, and I'm talking about the leaders, what their message of support to Israel, or how their message to support to Israel is understood by the Israelis. And I'm talking about the society and the political leadership alike. It is these messages, you know, if you don't Parliament House with Israeli colors of the Israeli flag, or the Eiffel Tower with the colors of the Israeli flag, Israelis understand it as a message which says, we absolve you from all the things you have done until the 7th of October, and you have now a free license to do whatever you want, regardless of international law and the law of wars in the Gaza Strip. I'm not sure every American and every British policymakers this is the kind of message they wanted Israel to have. I still hope some of them have a modicum of humanity in them. But what we know from the history of the Zionist lobby in America and in Britain, even if they would have now doubts whether they took the right decision by giving Israel this carte blanche, they would be very timid and careful not to challenge the Israeli lobby in their countries and be exposed to allegations of anti-Semitism and so on. So it's a situation where they are in a rabbit hole that they themselves put themselves in it. And this is on the assumption that at least some of them are not as callous as you have just described them, you know, totally indifferent to the images and the reports we are getting on an hourly basis from the Gaza Strip.
Well, they were proud about the few trucks coming across the Rafah crossing, of course. And for all the international isolation of these NATO powers as regards what's happening, why do you think Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, these administrations, feel it so necessary to talk about a two-state solution after all the work you've done, after all the work so many scholars have done to explain why only a one-state solution will solve this question?
Well, it's interesting you say that. I spent a very excellent 2 weeks in China in the beginning of this month teaching in Chinese universities. I also met a few diplomats from the Chinese foreign ministry. And I put that question to them as well. And I think the mission that both the Russian foreign ministry and the Chinese foreign ministry feel that they have now is to at least challenge the new discourse that the West is putting, that what matters now is to allow Israel to implement its destructive policies and only pay lip service to a solution in the future. So in a way, it is just an indicator that these two powers, these two global powers, might be more involved in the future and are still learning what should be their original position. Because I think also China and Russia, until recently, you know, if you think about the Russian participation in the quartet before, were allowing the West, and especially the United States, to be the main mediator, a very dishonest broker, but to be the main broker. If they want to replace it with maybe other countries like Brazil and South Africa as brokers, probably they would have to study again the origins of the conflict, the essence of the conflict, and hopefully they would understand that the two-state solution is not viable anymore, And if there is an international pressure, it should be towards a different kind of political solution.
Of course, given this discussion between us, would appall any member of Netanyahu's cabinet, let alone left-wing, so-called left-wing Israelis. How desperate could Israel, and I mean Netanyahu could of course go to jail anyway after this current killing, but how desperate could Israeli elites get? What is the nuclear weapon threat in Israel?
I think that so far, I really cannot predict. I can only tell you what I think happened so far. The Israeli elite is made of two main components. One is the political one, and the other one is the security organization, which includes the army, the Mossad, the Secret Service, and so on. Until today, the politicians were contained and limited in their actions against Iran by the people who came from the security pillar, so to speak. However, there is a demographic change in those institutions, and quite a lot of people who come from the settlements are now beginning to climb up in the echelons also of the security services. So I don't know how long this more, I would call it more pragmatic, you know, even more rational, I'm willing to give it to them, more rational approach towards Iran or the use of nuclear weapons, how long will it be sustained? If my fear, which would become true, that the demographics of that particular military and security elite will change with time. By the way, this elite does not help the Palestinians. You obviously can see it. They totally agree with the politicians about the destruction of the Palestinians and genocidal policies and ethnic cleansing policies. But when it comes to regional war, I think they're a bit more cautious than the right-wing politicians. So we have to watch and see whether this balance of power is changing in order to fully answer your right and important question.
Professor Ilan Pape, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And that's it for the show, and condolences from the whole team here at Going Underground to those bereaved by the ongoing violence here in the Middle East. We'll be back with a brand new episode on Saturday. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.